land is your land. This land is my land. From California.
Good evening. This is Heartstock Radio, and I'm your host, Carol Murphy. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. It is a beautiful, chilly. We've had lots of snow evening, afternoon here in Montana. And looking forward, it's supposed to warm up, so all that white stuff is going to go away. And just wanted to remind you that you can email us at heartstockradio@gmail.com. We're also on Facebook. This evening, our guest is Lisa Morales-Hellebo of Refashion Ventures and the Worldwide Supply Chain Federation, as well as the New York Supply Chain Meetup. She's got a lot going on. In just a moment, she will be back with us, and she'll tell you all about what she's up to. This is Heartstock. This is Heartstock Radio, and I'm your host, Carol Murphy. This evening, our guest is Lisa Morales-Hellebo. Hi, Lisa.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, thank you so much for being our guest. Please tell our listeners just a little intro here of what it is that you do.
Sure. It's kind of a harder thing to answer than most people because I wear many hats. I'm a VC, that's a venture capitalist, building my first ever venture fund to invest in emerging supply chain companies that are refashioning global and localized supply chains. So supply chain is kind of a nebulous concept to a lot of people. And if you ask anyone to define what is a supply chain, you'll get a billion different definitions. So under launching the Worldwide Supply Chain Federation, which is a network of grassroots meetups around the world, we decided to redefine what supply chain is. And we have a tagline that we trademarked that says it's the world is a supply chain. And that really is referring to the fact that everything can now speak to everything. And if you take that concept and apply it to business, that's a supply chain. It's no longer just about moving something from point A to point B. Your supply chains are blurring lines to consumer-facing experiences. And for the first time ever, we have massive migrations going from paper and Excel spreadsheets to digitized supply chains with blockchain, cyber-physical systems. It's a whole new revolution, and we're excited to be leading not only the dialogue, but investments.
And why did you take this on? Why did you decide to be a VC? Because you've had a lot of other endeavors previous to this, which I hope we have ample time to talk about all of them. But yeah, why supply chains? Why is that so important?
Yeah. Well, as my co-founder, Brian Long Owe, and I realized when we first met, he's from Ghana, a village in Ghana, and my family is from the mountains of Puerto Rico. We are both one generation removed from family members living in poverty, subsistence farmers, etc. And so we have an intimate relationship with how drastically efficiencies in supply chains can impact emerging markets. And so that's one of the reasons we decided to work together. But really, it came from my meandering path of a career. Let's be honest, I was not hoping and dreaming to be a VC when I was a little girl. I have a design degree from Carnegie Mellon. And all I knew I wanted to do when I grew up was something creative that made money. And lo and behold, I've used my design thinking degree throughout my career to really apply that process to business. And after building my first tech company called Shopsy that had went through Techstars Boston and raised some venture capital and ultimately failed, I realized that I could help the ecosystem and help my fellow founders that were building things in fashion tech by building the first ever Fashion Tech Lab, which was the New York Fashion Tech Lab with Springboard and the Partnership Fund for New York City. I got the C-suite executives from these massive global brands and retailers to not only fund the program, but to participate and give access to their C-suite executives and internal team members to get emerging startups in this space to a pilot or revenue, as opposed to just focusing on raising a round. And really during that, you know, better part of a year of building and launching that program, talking to the C-suite execs from these, from Macy's, J.Crew, Kate Spade, Ralph Lauren, Li & Fung, GBG, et cetera, behind closed doors, I became privy to some insights that most people didn't have and realized that everyone, VCs, executives at these companies, is focusing on the shiny objects of front-end consumer-facing agile experiences, but they were disregarding the fact that they have static backends. And so I'm a systems thinker. Systems 101 does not compute. You know, you can't have an agile front end with a static backend. So I was really intrigued by the $2.4 trillion industry that is fashion, and identified that only $250 billion, that paltry number, was being invested in fashion tech into paradigms that most VCs could comprehend because they matched a pattern they understood. But given that most VCs happen to be men, they invest in things that they know or have expertise in or feel an affinity towards. And lo and behold, a lot of dudes don't really care about fashion or retail or shopping. So it really just pointed me in this direction because I saw this $2.4 trillion opportunity of this fashion supply chain and retail industry that was way undercapitalized and for emerging technologies, and the fact that there's a preponderance of female founders that happen to be building things that are fashion tech, and the fact that the female founders receive less than 2% of all venture capital, I was like, is nobody else seeing this market? This is insane. So I said, somebody's got to capitalize this space, so it might as well be me. I left the New York Fashion Tech Lab and studied the apparel supply chain for the better part of a year to really get into maker labs, cut and sew shops, ateliers, factories of all different sizes as a student of learning the apparel supply chain because I'm a tech nerd. And so I took my insights and created a visual thesis because I'm a design thinker. I have to visualize everything and started sharing it with key players in the industry. And after meeting with a couple of private equity funds that said, we're deploying hundreds of millions of dollars into making Bangladesh and Chinese factories more green. And I said, oh, how so? Oh, installing solar and better light bulbs. I was like, no, that's not the future. So my vision, my thesis is that localization really is the best chance we have as a planet, localization of the apparel supply chain to catalyze sustainability, circularity, and transparency via on-demand production. And again, just tying things back to my career, my thesis was really proven out by what I had done in Silicon Valley during the first dot-com boom for P&G and Redpoint Ventures. I worked at a world-renowned mass customization, personalization, and micro-manufacturing company that did cosmetic, skincare, hair care, and fine fragrance. And I figured if we were doing that in 99, 2000, what's possible today for fashion? And it turns out the fourth industrial revolution of everything being able to talk to everything else thanks to 5G, cyber physical systems, IoT, we're at the early advent of this whole new era in business. And I believe it's a bigger opportunity even than the dawn of the internet, because this is the dawn of the Internet of Things. When everything can speak to everything, that's a massive global opportunity. And it's really truly being built from the ground up because its predecessors were paper and Excel spreadsheets. It's an exciting time. And I happen to think that venture is something creative that makes money. I mean, what's more creative than being able to decide what businesses get to exist in this world?
Well, it's an important point in time, that's for sure. And I wanted to delve in just a little bit more. When you said that the back end was static, can you explain for our listeners a little bit more about what you mean by that?
Sure. So fashion, many people, it's such an opaque industry. Many people also just don't even ever think about where their clothing comes from. So every single garment in this world has been created using human hands. And for the most part, everyone has been chasing this race to the bottom by producing things in the cheapest possible country where they can get the cheapest possible labor. So you can have fast fashion and buy a t-shirt for $5. When you think about it, that's truly insane. That a t-shirt that a human spent time sewing together, cutting apart the pattern, designing, sourcing the materials, all of that, and even after it's shipped from overseas to the U.S., is sold for just, $5, $10, even $20 is insane. There's no way that that labor is being paid a fair living wage, and it's highly toxic for the planet. Even just sourcing of textiles. Textiles is one of the largest polluting industries on the planet, and it takes a lot of raw materials, natural resources. The average t-shirt travels about 10,000 miles from soil to grow the cotton or whatever the fiber is to store. And if we localize that, we can implement the latest emerging technologies to create a distributed collaborative network of micro manufacturing hubs. And so if you have small facilities where people start with cut and sew, just like they did overseas, but we start implementing robotics so that 95% of the process is done using advanced machinery and the human hand is minimized, you suddenly have higher paying jobs for skilled labor that know how to operate this machinery. You have redistribution of global wealth where we can have these distributed collaborative hubs really transitioning to the raw materials being the volume and the finished goods being one-off. So if your volume is raw materials and we want to make this circular, we can take existing textile waste, finished goods, finished clothing, and through technologies like Evernew's News Cycle, we can break down finished goods that are returned to the store. We recycle them and break it down to its molecules where it can be reconstituted into new fiber or new pulp, new fiber and new textiles, and go through that process four times before it breaks down to its sugars. Then those sugars can be fed to bacteria to create new fiber. So the globalized textile supply chain then becomes irrelevant because we're filling the world with textile waste. We have plenty of raw materials. We just needed emerging technologies to catch up and allow us to truly have everything that we consume be created within, say, a 200-mile radius.
Let's get into that some more. But first, I really want to back up just a few steps and talk more about where did you grow up? What were your early inspirations? This is a big bite that you have taken on here. And I'm really excited listening to you. But I'm also curious, what were your influences early in life that led you to where you are now?
Yeah, well, I'm a Puerto Rican from the Bronx that grew up in Westchester, just like AOC. Actually, we grew up in the same town, Yorktown. And my family, my dad was a principal in the South Bronx, and my mom was a stay-at-home mom. We didn't have a ton of money growing up. And as a little girl that was obsessed with fashion from as far back as I can remember, I would design clothing with my mom, go to the fabric store and pick out patterns and textiles, and then come home and modify patterns and create designs with her that I would want to wear, because my dad was the only one that really could afford to buy clothing because he had to leave the house and go to work. And so the rest of us, we produced our own stuff, literally like the Von Trapps. I have a picture of me when I was little wearing a gingham like Holly Hobby type dress, and the drapes behind me are the same gingham. So it really was an early just obsession with fashion and how it impacts how people perceive you and just the beauty of design. I became obsessed in the 80s with Fabian Baron's designs for, I believe it was Bazaar, and his typography. So I studied graphic design at Carnegie Mellon. And again, only because I had always been drawing. And when I was like 6 or 7, I would ask my mom for magazines. I'd cut them up and redo the layouts. And lo and behold, that's graphic design. Mm-hmm. For me, that was just play as a little girl. I could spend hours just doing that and doodling. So I applied to Carnegie Mellon, not really knowing what graphic design was. And the head of the design department back then, Carol Gantz, after my interview said, "Congratulations, we'll be seeing you in the fall." And so I was, I went into graphic design. It's really fortuitous that I knew enough in high school that I wanted to do something creative that made money, but I didn't want to apply to just a fine arts school. I knew that it would be important to have a proper university. And so I found the school that had the best design program that was also the best university. And Carnegie Mellon was the only school I applied to. So glad I got in.
And what was that experience like there? Did it meet your expectations?
Oh my God, yeah. Carnegie Mellon really is a special school. It's small and intimate, but it is really bleeding edge. In every department, they excel, from fine arts to design to architecture, engineering, robotics. You know, we have a lot of drama students that have won Tonys and Emmys and Oscars. It's just an exceptional school all around. And I tell people that no matter what you do, you're really getting a degree in thinking, how to think. And so for me, it was just design thinking as a process that could be applied to everything. And lo and behold, today, design thinking is one of the most highly sought after skills, along with data science. And I taught myself data science, and I have a degree in design thinking. So here I am.
So we will be back. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll learn more. This is Heartstock.
Sparkling sands of perpetual deserts, and all around me a voice was sounding. This land was made with me. The sun comes shining.
And we've been speaking with Lisa Morales Calabo. And I think where we really want to go next is to talk about this whole localizing of the supply chain, because, you know, I thought about this an awful lot. And I was looking at, for example, hemp textiles. Here in Montana, we just legalized production, farmers growing hemp. It's like, well, then what do you do with it once you grow? Because we don't have any of the other infrastructure to actually take that hemp plant and the fibers and turn it into textiles or really a whole lot of anything else at this point. So how do we challenge this? Or how do we take it on and solve it? Because it's important.
So obviously, I've been thinking about this for a while, just a mere 5 years since I built the New York Fashion Tech Lab, and validating it and talking to experts in the industry. And frankly, I was floored that after I'd done my research and come up with my own thesis around localization, sharing it with executives at companies like Li & Fung and SAP and, you know, huge corporations, that they said, no, we're not seeing anything like this anywhere. And I said, that can't be true. I'm just a student trying to catch up to where the industry's headed. And they said, no, this is something unique. And so I really doubled down on trying to understand strategically how it could be deployed in a meaningful way as quickly as humanly possible. Because we have 10 good years left, folks, you know, according to all climate change scientists. So trying to retrofit this massive global supply chain node by node is just insanity. We've been trying to do that literally for 36 years, and we've moved the needle like maybe an inch of a mile. So to do this, you have to look at it from all sides of the equation. And I was solving for the fact that fashion had $50 billion of dead stock inventory in the U.S. in 2018. And they need to obviously optimize to eliminate that. Everyone that I know in apparel is focused feverishly on artificial intelligence to better target their forecasting. And I said, well, forecasting becomes irrelevant if you can literally produce something on demand at the point of sale. You don't have to predict what the consumer wants to create. You will have her help inform you, you know, right at the point of sale. So that's for business. And then for the consumer, we've trained the world to love fast fashion. Shame on us. And we've addicted them to it at a low price point. It's far easier to build a better mousetrap than it is to try to change people's perspectives or choices. And so the better mousetrap really is focusing on what sort of infrastructure can be deployed to incentivize circularity. So if you trade in your old t-shirt at the point of sale, watch it be shredded or whatever it is to get that feeling that you're contributing back into the ecosystem and get an instant credit maybe to your mobile device after you've traded in an item, that you have credit towards buying a new t-shirt from that brand or any of the brands that use this infrastructure. That is a real incentive. Right now, many stores are just saying, oh, trade in your old t-shirts or trade in your old clothes and we'll give you 15% off your next purchase. There's no real communication of what the value prop is. And frankly, most of these brands don't really know what to do with the inventory once they take it back. And so textile waste either ends up in landfill or incinerated, about 80% of all textile waste. That has been our historic solution for this waste. Or we've been shipping it overseas to Africa, et cetera, and saying, here, take our used t-shirts. And frankly, these other countries don't want our waste anymore. If you send t-shirts to a village in Africa, then the local textile makers and seamstresses are losing their jobs. So we're not really helping anyone by sharing our waste. And then we've been shipping it overseas by the container full, and these third world countries are frankly shipping it back to us now saying, yep, we're no longer taking your trash. Figure out what to do with it on your own. So legislation has started dropping, being led out of the UK and France. Really, Stella McCartney has been a leader on driving this new legislation to wake up the world to the reality that textile waste is killing our planet. It's killing it on the way into the world by having cotton grown. It's one of the highest crops for water consumption. It usually is processed in a global network, so shipped all over the place, treated all over the place. It's really just not a sustainable resource. Even if it's organic and fair trade, that's fabulous. But really, truly, the only way to minimize the impact on the planet is to create everything locally. So the third side is the planet. We have business, the consumers, and the planet. How do we solve for all sides of the equation? And coming up with this solution, it really is looking at that for a solution on all sides. And when I started getting validation from some of these big brands that this was a really unique solution, it's because I wasn't hired as a consultant to solve a problem for a specific brand. I truly was just curious and wanted to solve the problem for the planet, for business, and for people. And so you don't start by boiling the ocean. You start by working with small batch, quick turn, cut and sew, good old fashioned human hands, and finding smaller local factories that can pay a living wage and produce things quickly in the United States. And then you layer on a shared data layer, intelligence, throughput, capacity, load bearing, shared localized logistics to shuttle around the resources, materials, finished goods, and last mile delivery to consumers. And your raw materials now becomes that recycled textiles. Trade in your old t-shirt will give you credit towards buying anything new. And those t-shirts can all be sourced locally. So you can consume and create everything really within about a 200-mile radius. You no longer have to be looking at globalized textile supply chains. But to do that, your raw materials, you have to start with the simplest, most ubiquitous use case, and that is cellulose-based fibers, whichever new focused on. And cellulose-based fibers basically is t-shirts, athleisure, anything like that, which happens to be about 90% of what Americans wear. So we produce four times the textile waste of any other country in the world, Americans. And if we can use that waste now as our raw material, you can actually create a circular network, regionalized, but focusing, starting on just t-shirts and athleisure.
So there's, I'm sure, a lot of technology and just the recycling and processing of the recycled t-shirts requires an awful lot of equipment and whatnot. Is that what you're focused on, or are you focused more on the data and the tracking of the materials and the, you know, making sure that everybody needs it, gets what they need?
Kind of all of the above. It's a massive project. Yeah. And I've been moving the giant chess pieces that are the industry leaders on all sides of the equation of this for 5 years. And we're finally getting somewhere. This requires collaboration. That, frankly, has been the biggest hurdle so far, finding a brand champion that understands that for this to work, some company needs to step forward and say, we believe this is absolutely necessary for the future of our planet, for the future of human life on the planet, and frankly, for the future of fashion companies to exist. So having them step forward as a champion and having the other strategic enterprise companies aligned around that initial brand and saying, yes, we believe in this vision too. We would like to come on board as strategic partners once you've deployed an initial pilot. Starting just focusing on the actual physical infrastructure, connecting existing small factories in the New York metro area with data from actual big brand stores, this champion that has stepped forward, and figuring out what their best-selling SKUs are, producing them small batch on demand locally. It really is a no-brainer place to start. And that's the infrastructure that's needed. That's step one of this million mile journey to get to where we need to go. So we're focused on setting up that physical infrastructure, learning the use cases and all of the information that will eventually be the foundation for the refashioned OS, the operating layer that manages all of these different APIs and data sources across this localized supply chain.
I'm excited to see what the future brings. In the meantime, how might our listeners find you and learn more?
Sure. My fund's website is refashioned.com. And that's, we don't have an E at the end. We're like one of the cool kids startups. Just the word refashion with a D.com. My personal website is lisahellebo.com. And I'm on, you know, Twitter and Instagram and everything at Lisa Hellebo.
Thank you so much, Lisa, for being our guest on Heartstock. And thank you so much for the work that you're doing. It's impressive. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I'm Carol Murphy, your host. We shall see you next week. Peace.
And on the sign it said, no chance.
Heartstock Radio is a production of KBMF 102.5 Butte America Radio. Hear our live programs every Friday at 5 p.m. Mountain Standard Time via live stream at buteamericaradio.org. That time will be.